a long, long time. I've mentored and consulted with executives that just describe the shrapnel of these kinds of relational environments with such vivid detail, but yet they feel stuck on this treadmill of performance. The life you live trains you for the life you're going
to
lead.
Welcome to the Alter Group podcast on real estate. I'm your host, Tom Silva. Our guests today are Michael Lee Stallard and Jason Pankow of E Pluribus Partners, the world's leading experts on how rational and emotional connections can boost productivity, innovation, and organizational performance in the workplace. Michael and Jason, I want to talk today about happiness and work. So let me open by reporting a new survey done across 132 countries by the Gallup organization that reports the United States ranks number 12 in terms of happiness, well below Scandinavian countries and even below Costa Rica. So give me a sense of the extent to which you think that what's happening in the general economy and the way people are working today, how that's affecting our happiness.
Well, I mean, if you look at what's happening these days, especially in America, but even across the world, you know, people are working longer and harder days, and now people are looking for work. And if we're spending the bulk of our waking lives in certain kinds of relational environments, it's going to have a huge impact on our happiness and our ability to connect with others at home. And, you know, you kind of bring it all with you. What we're finding is the corporations that understand how to create what we call a connection culture are not only more successful, they're enjoying the journey that much more as well.
So let's look at what it is that makes us happy. If you look at humanistic psychology, particularly Abraham Maslow, they believed it was a hierarchy, that you first satisfied your physiological needs, then your safety needs, and then love and esteem. And then finally, at the top of the pyramid was this idea of self-actualization, being able to express yourself through your work, seeing your potential realized. Do you agree with that, Jason?
I absolutely do. And I do like Abraham Maslow and some of these other guys that are working on the concept of basic universal human needs, you know, to function. We actually have kind of looked at a lot of the different research and culled out what we go and present to companies as the six universal human needs that we believe people are looking to get met in the workplace. So how are people in, let's say, third world countries able to be much more joyful, much more happy, if we're going to use that word, than we are in America? And, you know, two-thirds of the world are living on less than $2 a day. And I could take you to places around the world where they just enjoy life much more than your average American.
So one of the things they found in the survey is that once you've achieved a certain standard of living, there really isn't any correlation between income and happiness. And I've heard speculation that the top two countries in the list, Denmark and Finland, could in some way explain how happy their population is because of their reduced expectations, some might describe it as. Would you agree with that? Expectations has a lot to do with it?
I totally agree with that. I mean, one of the things we talk about is the difference between expectations and reality is depression. So I do think that we've got these hugely elevated expectations about what real living is all about here in America, and they're just not real. They're just not life-giving, and they're not relationally based either. A lot of them seem to be about achievement-based or get this next product. Of course, advertising does a good job getting us all hyped into a frenzy on that. But we've got to be very careful. You know, when I do our executive coaching with the different people that I work with, a lot of times it's re-gauging expectations so that they can appreciate all that they do have. Because it's like they're looking at the 15% that's wrong rather than the 85% that's so amazing about their lives. And they can't let that in.
So, Mike, let's talk about happiness and work. Well, you've mentioned that there are six needs that need to be satisfied. Why don't you take us through those?
Okay, sure. The six universal human needs to thrive at work are, the first is respect. In other words, we need, and you will see, you mentioned Abraham Maslow, who, of course, was a humanistic psychologist mid-last century. and former president of the American Psychological Association. You'll see his work as well as others, Csikszentmihalyi and Ed Deci at the University of Rochester, others. We really looked at all the research out there and tried to summarize it into these six universal human needs to thrive at work. The first is respect, that if we're around people who are condescending or patronizing or passive-aggressive, they look down on us in some way, that has a negative emotional impact, and we can't thrive under those circumstances. We need that basic level of respect in the workplace environment and certainly in the environments we're in outside of work as well. The second is recognition. I always think of it as we have this battery in our back that we can't reach. The receptacle to charge the battery is out of reach, and we rely on the interactions we have with people around us to charge that battery. If it's not charged, it is drained of energy, and we are drained of energy. But if it is charged on a regular basis, it has to, of course, be authentic affirmation or recognition. It can't be false. Then that gives us energy. Then third, we need a sense of belonging. You know, Jason, my good friend, always says, you know, I've got your back. And Jason's one of the people I have in my life who were very close friends, and I know I can count on him as a friend. We all need those group of people who have our back, who we trust, who help us live up to the values we aspire to and support us. We just have challenges we face in life. It could be the death of a loved one or sickness or personal health issues, loss of a job, etc. There are just ups and downs in life, and we tend to thrive if we have that group of people in our lives who we're doing life with, outside of work and in work as well. The next two needs are called task mastery needs, but we separate them because they're somewhat different. The first being autonomy. We need the flexibility, the freedom in our to do our work. If we're subject to a lot of bureaucracy or red tape or over-controlling individuals, I always think of Nurse Ratched from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, if you remember that movie. We can't thrive when we're subject to that kind of over-controlling personality or over-controlling bureaucratic red tape. And that needs to be coupled, the need for autonomy has to be coupled with personal growth. In other words, we're in a role, a particular role, that is a good fit with our strengths, and it provides the right degree of challenge. If it's over-challenging, we're stressed out. If it's under-challenging, we're bored. But if it provides the right degree of challenge, then we experience what psychologists call flow or optimal experience. And I just think of it as we're immersed in our work so much that the time flies by. It's almost as if we enter into a time warp. And I think just about everybody has experienced that some in life. And, of course, that's very good. It energizes us. And that's one of our needs we have to thrive in life and in work. And then, finally, the need for meaning is the sixth need of the six universal human needs to thrive at work.
Now, Michael, you have a very personal story that you tell that connects to this whole idea of meaning. Can you share that with us?
When my wife had breast cancer and then advanced ovarian cancer, today she's cancer-free, I should say that. But when one of our treatments was at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City, and we were on our first visit to Sloan Kettering, we were walking down the sidewalk, and there's this big doorman named Nick who locked his eyes on Katie and greeted her like a returning friend in Midtown Manhattan where nobody's making eye contact. And we got to know Nick and found out that he was a cancer survivor who attributed his survival to the treatment he received at Sloan Kettering. So his job provided so much meaning for him. It connected with his personal life, and as a result, he is a huge ambassador for Sloan Kettering. You would not believe the number of people in New York City who know Nick because their lives have, they've interacted with Nick in some way as cancer patients or family members to cancer patients. So that's just one example of someone who has meaning from their work.
And that connects to the whole field of existential psychologists, particularly people like Rollo May and Viktor Frankl. In fact, Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. Can we glean anything from those thinkers?
Well, I would say, and you mentioned Viktor Frankl. Let me just share a little bit of his work because I think it's very relevant. And Frankl said that people usually derive meaning from, number one, their work that is consistent with a mission that's important to them, like the example I used of Nick at Sloan Kettering. That's one. But in addition to that, they also find meaning in the relationships they have, the connections, relational connections they have in the workplace. And although Frankl doesn't talk about this, I would say there's another source of meaning, and that is when the personal, the values of an individual are consistent with the values of the organization.
And who would you offer as an example of that?
Anita Roddick, when she founded the Body Shop, one of her values was that they were anti-animal testing. Another was what she called trade for aid. And the whole idea was that she was sourcing her products in developing countries from women-owned businesses, and it would provide them a source of income because she would sell their products in the developed world. And so this was it was less related to, somewhat related to mission, but also it was the way they did what they did. You know, they were kind of a cosmetics company, natural cosmetics and products. But the way they did what they did was different. It was their values and the way they went about it that really connected with a lot of employees and provided a source of meaning. So those are just three examples that I think of how meaning is met through the workplace.
So is this why philanthropy, for example, or volunteer days are important within a corporate environment in order to create that connection culture you refer to? Jason, you want to address that?
Yeah, I mean, it's well established that engaging in something that's larger than yourself or beyond yourself is very connecting, right? It definitely engages people. I do think that is something that we don't drift towards naturally, though, unfortunately. Most of us drift towards more of a self-centered pursuit, and it becomes extraordinarily disengaging. You know, 75 to 85% of the American workforce are describing themselves as disengaged, right, from what they do. This is a huge problem.
There's been enormous medical breakthroughs with the Human Genome Project and neuroscience. What has that revealed in terms of what it is that makes us happy or connected?
I mean, as much as science is progressing and we're learning so much about human beings, you know, biochemically, psychologically, you know, social psychology, we're learning so much. And as we did our research, all the data points are all saying the exact same thing. We're relational beings who are designed to connect, and connection leads to life. Disconnection leads to death in every measurable way, biochemically, just lifespan, just the enjoyment of the journey along the way. Everything says we need to proactively, intentionally build connected, deep relationships if we're going to really maximize our journey.
Now, what are the CEOs of America telling you both about the issue of connection and the issue of what their corporate cultures are like today?
For a long, long time, I've mentored and consulted with executives that just describe the shrapnel of these kinds of relational environments with such vivid detail, but yet they feel stuck on this treadmill of performance. And, you know, one of the things I like to say is the life you live trains you for the life you're going to lead. So if I spend, again, the bulk of my waking life in these cold, disconnected, people really aren't caring for me, they just want performance, so show up and perform, and we buy into that. I mean, I'm a two-sport, you know, preseason All-American from Brown University, and, you know, I understand how to run the achievement treadmill, but it leaves us all a little bit dry and disconnected. And the longer you go on that journey, in some ways, the harder it is to unlearn and relearn a new way. You know, the life you live trains you for the life you're going to lead. And it's that subtle creep over time of getting, you know, kind of more and more relationally tight and disconnecting until, you know, divorce happens or something else. And it's usually until, you know, somebody pulls the emergency hatch here until we finally wake up and go, hey, I've got a relationship problem here. And we really need to help people see that your natural drift is toward disconnection, not towards connection. We need to proactively build relationships.
And one of the things that CEOs need to understand also is that connection makes you healthier, doesn't it? There is an actual health benefit here.
But just to touch on the tip of the iceberg. When people feel this sense of connection, it reduces stress hormones like epinephrine, norepinephrine, cortisol. Those are fight or flight hormones that really excite our senses, but the negative effect they have is we become more rational and reactional rather than rational. And actually, when you look at fMRI scans of the brain, when we're in higher stress environments, the brain activity starts to shift from the frontal lobes of the brain to the midbrain that is more rash than rational. The front part of the brain, the frontal lobes, are called the executive function. So, to counter that, research has discovered that when people feel connected, even in stressful environments, those stress hormones are reduced, and the brain activity stays toward the front of the brain. So we just, under stress, we make more rational decisions. And also, feeling connected boosts dopamine, which enhances attention and pleasure. It boosts serotonin, which reduces fear and worry and the sense of anxiety that people have. It also boosts oxytocin, which is a hormone that makes us feel more trusting of the people around us. So it's just fascinating to see these the physiological impact on the human body when people feel connected, how that boosts performance in a positive sense. And when they're in a stressful environment, if they're not connected, the negative impact. In fact, if some of those stress hormones remain at high levels, it literally starts to eat away at some of the organs in our body. And you can see that effect on people. If they're isolated and they're in highly stressful environments, you will see them age very rapidly.
And we can expand this into a sort of developmental model, can't we, where we show that from birth right up to our senior years, that connection makes you thrive as a human being.
We see from the time we're infants to our twilight years in life that, say, for example, babies who feel connected to their caregivers have a mental and physical health advantage that lasts all their lives. Elementary school students who feel connected to their teachers because they receive eye contact and affirming head nods, they perform better academically. Adolescents who feel connected to their families or their friends, they're less likely to get in trouble. Adults who feel connected are more creative, they're better problem solvers, and this is research that has established this, so not just anecdotal information, but actual research. And then finally, seniors who feel connected are less likely to get sick. If they get sick, they recover faster, and no surprise, they live longer. So from birth to our twilight years, connection makes us perform better, both in terms of length of life and quality of life.
So for the CEO out there who is focused on operational performance, how would you convince them about the importance of building a connection culture?
So we think the a model we have is that sustainable superior performance requires achieving both task excellence and relationship excellence. And we have to be intentional about developing task excellence with things like metrics and Six Sigma and benchmarking and dashboards, et cetera. That's been great. However, if you focus on that alone and you're not intentional about developing relationship excellence, the lack of to achieve relationship excellence will sabotage task excellence every time. And typically what happens is you just find the type of statistics that we see in the workplace now where 75% of the employees are not engaged, they're not giving their best efforts, and of the 25% who are engaged, 60% of them are not aligned with organizational objectives. So the bottom line is 90% of employees are either not giving their best efforts or they're not aligning their behavior with organizational goals. So it's holding us back in terms of our performance, and we're starting to see diminishing economic productivity in America because we've been pushing so hard for so long that people are running out of gas, and they're dysfunctioning, both in the C-suite and the broader employees at large. So it's a question of America has certainly been very productive, and that's been great. But if we don't maintain some balance, it's not sustainable, and that is what our research really points out, is to make economic productivity sustainable over a long period of time, then you have to be intentional and develop both task excellence and relationship excellence.
Well, Michael and Jason, I wanted to thank you for joining us today, and I also wanted to invite our listeners to listen to part two of this podcast, where we're going to look at the components of a connection culture, and we're also going to talk about some of the great leaders who embrace connection, including Bono from U2, which should be really interesting. So stay tuned for that, and again, thank you for joining us today. To listen to more Alter Group podcasts or to read our Alter Now blog, visit www.altergroup.com.